Good afternoon. We will start the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. Sorry we're a half hour late today. The Senate floor session went longer than usual, and so Sue...
Didn't wield a fast gavel.
we're moving along pretty good for a while. Got stalled on 3 minutes. Sue, what should we start with?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I just would call your attention to some of the handouts that you have before you. The department apparently came back with some sample reports from the database initiative project website. I think it was Representative Schrader who had asked for some samples. And then you have behind that some information on the quality education model, which you will hear about today. And we have Department of Education staff and the governor's education and workforce policy advisor and quality education commission representatives here today to talk about that.
Good. Okay, so who do we start with? Okay. And we're in public hearing number. So I would like to start with Nancy and Jean Thorne. And and Duncan also. Jean, you act surprised. Are you surprised?
I am.
I always say something.
Yeah, I guess that's why you're on there. And Duncan, would you come up there also? And
yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Director of School Finance for the Department of Education. Today we have with us the members of the Quality Education Commission who are prepared to report to you on the results of their work over the past year. Tomorrow the department is intending to present information on our accountability planning and also to hear from Jean Thorne on Measure 1.
Mr. Chair, Jean Thorne of the Governor's Office. I'm really pleased to have members of the Commission here today to make this presentation. I would just like to note these were 11 very hard working people. They put an incredible amount of time into the work of reviewing and refining the quality education model. In turn, there were a number of panels, as you'll hear from, that had much broader input and involvement from a broad array of stakeholders, and I think the product they arrived at is a very good one. The intent is that the quality education model is a model in progress. And in model and process, and that what we have here with the quality education model is a much better grounding in helping policymakers make decisions around the K-12 budget, and that over time, as we get more and more data on the connection between schools, student success, and the cost, that will continue to become more sophisticated and inform policymakers so that in the future you and others after you can have more and better data to make those decisions on. As Nancy noted, today they will be talking to you about the quality education model as a whole, and then tomorrow we'll come back and talk about how the governor then used the quality education model to frame his budget and to meet the requirements of Measure 1. So I'm here really to listen today. I'll be back to present tomorrow.
Thank you. Duncan, would you like to come forward and bring your people? Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed in whatever order you want.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Thorndike, Jr. I'm a private businessman from Southern Oregon, from the Medford area, and had the privilege of chairing the Quality Education Commission for the governor and for the superintendent of public instruction, and it was, again, a great amount of work and a pleasure to do. Presenting today will be my co-chair, Elaine Taylor, who is the superintendent from the McMinnville School District, Duncan Weiss, Oregon Business Council president, and we're very pleased to have Yvonne Curtis, who will be giving a little perspective from the school that she's the principal of, Terrebonne Elementary School in Central Oregon. basically then what we'll do is do a little introduction, have Duncan work on the executive summary, talk about the model in brief by Superintendent Taylor, the commission process Elaine will be talking about, and then getting into the cost estimates and how it actually works down back to a school level, issues for final work, and then our wrap up. The charge that was developed for us by the superintendent, by the governor, was first and foremost to identify the key issues for amending, validating, refining the original model that was produced during the last legislative session. We did this by a number of different means. First of all, we solicited input from educators, education policy experts, and others, actually trying to define the elements of the model so that we could get it down into understandable parts and to be dealt with. Then we also were charged with soliciting public input regarding education priorities. We were able to work closely with the education leadership team, and also through Public Affairs Council, did some surveying and some research statewide. What we wanted to make sure was there was a connection between the elements as the education community identified them and what the priorities of not only the policymakers in the state, but also the citizens of the state. And so, again, that was a very valuable tool. Once those were done, and we also had the pleasure of receiving the report of Representative Hobson and Winters' committee that was also working during the interim with their input from the teacher's perspective, we brought all of this information together, and you'll hear about how we used the panel process to basically distill research and practice and come up with what we think was required relative to meeting the goals that the legislature has placed around education. Finally, our charge was to communicate with stakeholders regarding the model development. And again, as Jean Thorne mentioned, this is very much a work in progress and will improve with additional work. But I think hopefully that will come through clearly that the time that was spent this last 2 years has greatly enhanced and improved the quality of the model relative to what it can do. I think the interesting thing with the quality education model is that basically it is two things. First of all, it's a big picture. It's trying to allow us collectively to determine the amount of dollars and resources required from the state to meet the quality education goals that have been established in statute up to this point. It's a big number. The other thing, which I think is actually more important, is using the quality education model as a framework, as a policy tool that decision makers can use to actually develop educational budgets, develop a level of accountability, develop a level of understanding amongst not only the citizens of the state, but the policymakers, so that we can have a more intelligent discussion about what we should expect for our resources and also hopefully continuously improve the product that we're asking our schools to do for us. So as we refer to it as the OQEM 2000, we'd like to say that it's a powerful tool that begins to link funding with student performance, and again, you'll be hearing more from that from our other panelists. I think it's clear, and we'll talk about it when we get to some other issues, but that to have accountability, you have to have some agreement on the ground rules and the process, and we think that this is an excellent place to start. So in essence, again, a collection of stakeholders got together and spent the time to dig in. We looked at this from national basis, from within our own state, trying to look at it from as many different facets as possible. And so what we'd like to do now is I'd like to turn it over to Duncan, who will, in his very skillful way, do the executive summary. I think that when we first presented this to the governor and the superintendent, I think Duncan had a 15-minute presentation that he did in 5 minutes, but everybody pretty much understood what was going on. So I'd like to turn it over to Duncan Wise, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Bill. Members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I am president of the Oregon Business Council and was a member of the Quality Education Commission. what I'd like to do is really briefly summarize it, and then we're going to come back and examine individual pieces in much more detail, but just to make sure you have the whole in mind as we get started. And before I do the executive summary, I would just like to comment, as someone who's been in this meeting room at this point in the legislative session in the last number of sessions, you would just notice the difference in the room today versus what you might have seen in the past. And I think the quality education model may help explain. In the past, what you would, of course, have seen were a lot of folks coming in with very loud voices, arguing for a very large number without much data behind them to justify it one way or the other. It was a very different kind of ways and means process than any other committee you would have experienced. What this is about is trying to bring good quality data, good information to you in a more systematic way, what you're used to seeing in a ways and means process, much more formally. And I think you'll see today that we have a lot of new and good information, and that I think, as Bill says, it'll get better over time. So why I'm thrilled to be here is I hope this is the beginning of a very different ways and means process for K-12 education in the future, and one that I think you'll find more satisfying in creating a better ability for you to make good decisions around this very critical issue. This is the culmination of at least 6 years' work in different forms and different phases. What are we trying to do? What we hope to accomplish with the QEM is to take the guesswork out of state funding decisions and give you a tool to make wise decisions. We think, whatever your perspective, you have a very powerful tool to understand the implications of whatever funding number you pick on what will actually happen in schools across the state of Oregon. Using the QEM model, you can set funding levels and performance expectations. At the same time you set those expectations, you still allow the schools to make decisions on how to spend those dollars, but you have your own expectations up front about what you would expect them to be doing. You can then hold the schools accountable for meeting the results you want, and you can see with the database project that I believe Nancy presented earlier, you can actually see the results of how the schools spend their money and what their performances are in every single school building in the state. This is a revolutionary redesign of the budgeting system of K-12 education. You set expectations, you set budgets, and you create performance expectations that you can then track with the database project in every school in the state. Our vision with this model is a high-performing school system that have adequate resources, the educational practices defined for the schools are based on best practices, and that your funding level is tied to the performances that you're expecting for the schools. We think there are enormous benefits of using this approach. We think this is a pivotal tool for building a world-class education system, including more students hitting benchmarks, reducing dropout rates. We should stress, and I think every member of the commission felt very strongly about this, we understand fully that a quality education is not simply about meeting test scores. The benchmarks are important. I know we all are focused on those, but we also feel it's very important that all Oregon children have a well-rounded education, and we included that perspective as we built this model. We do set performance expectations in this model using the state expectations, and we would note that as we've tracked schools over the last several years, there have been substantial improvements, especially in the early grade levels. What this model does is try to understand how additional resources may lead to additional performance improvement in our schools and to be able to track the dollars with those performances. In the end, there's a bottom line to this model. We came up with a number in the end. And the number, when we asked what would it take to meet the quality education goals established by the legislature in statute, when we tried to envision what the schools would look like that could reasonably be expected to meet those goals, you will see it's a larger number than I think you're likely to appropriate in this committee this year. It came out to about $6 billion. That was our estimate. You can challenge our estimates. It was our best judgment based on what we thought best practices were and what it would cost in individual schools in Oregon around the state. And we came up with an ADMW number, and that became what we believe is necessary. But the other wonderful feature about this model is it allows you to do implementation options. As you will see, what we try to do is examine what a school, an elementary and a middle and a high school, could look like. And if you want to adjust what those schools look like, you can come up with different numbers, as we have done with the QEM. This is not about a particular funding level. It is about understanding what any particular funding level can reasonably be expected to produce in schools in Oregon. And that's the beauty of it. You don't have to buy any particular number, but it's a powerful, flexible tool that you can use in the ways and means process to understand what different funding levels will mean in terms of student outcomes in Oregon. So that's we spent a good deal of time working on priorities, and as you see later, we will give you some suggestions on how you might spend additional dollars using the model. With that, as a quick overview, I'd like to turn it to Elaine, who will then get into more details on the model itself.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Elaine Taylor, Superintendent of McMinnville School District. The Quality Ed model estimates the statewide cost for K-12 education using prototype schools. It develops educational programs at each school. It calculates the cost on a per student basis, and then it multiplies that times the expected number of students statewide. As Duncan has said, you can use it to cost changes at various levels. For example, if we want to calculate the cost of lowering the class size in primary grades by 3, this tool will allow us to do that. Similarly, if we would be looking at a $100 million decrease in the funding of K-12 education, we can also make some estimates as to that impact statewide. We have provided you today with a handout that compares the components of the baseline prototype schools to the fully funded models. The purpose is to give you an estimate of the difference between the current school resources and those that are proposed in the fully funded model, as recommended by the Commission. The baseline prototype schools included in these basically show you its summaries. The full report here would contain more detailed information about staffing, instructional time, supplies, materials, and so forth. Each of the prototype schools includes a number of major components. And then through the process of developing these prototype schools, we have identified what we believe to be the necessary enhancements in order to experience an increase in student achievement. I would call your attention to a couple of this short list here in terms of the priorities that evolved. One, adding time for students having trouble reaching the standards, and a second, the necessity of professional development for teachers and administrators. Looking at the elementary prototype, we focused on a school of 340 students, and of course, if the school were smaller or larger, the resources would be proportional. But in the full model, here are some of the components that would be enhancements specifically at the elementary level. The recommendation for all-day kindergarten, the lowering of a class size average to 20 in primary grades, and you can see 24 for grades 4 and 5, and then providing each elementary school a menu of specialists to support the educational program there. The middle school prototype was built on a school that would have 500 students. Again, resources adjusted depending on what that student population would be. There we've identified a maximum class size of 29 for the core academic areas, and in addition to that, teachers who would specialize and give support for students in math, English, and science, alternative programs for special needs students, a volunteer coordinator at the middle level, because we know that's when parent involvement seems to drop off dramatically from the elementary. The last two are, I think, recommendations that reflect the reality today in that our students need counseling services, and we're recommending one for every 250 students, and we need adequate campus security. The components that are recommended in the high school model are very similar to those of the middle school model. And again, this school, the prototype, would have 1,000 students. But in addition to the components for the middle school, you can also see that we have recommended a school-to-work coordinator who would support applied learning experiences for students. I want to emphasize again that these are prototype schools, and each school district and school would make their own local decisions on how to best allocate the resources in order to create high-performance learning experiences. The committee also discussed the need for high school restructuring, and they identify this as an issue that needs further study. One of the more difficult tasks that the commission had was forecasting the student performance.
Elaine, Representative Schrader wants to ask a question.
Okay. I'm sorry. Looking kind of from the bottom up, it looks like most of the administrative and centralized services are fully funded, baseline and prototype. And so when we get down to the classroom that there seem to be problems. Is that an accurate read of the...
In comparing the two models, Representative Schrader, what I'm hearing you say is just that you don't observe any increase or enhancement into the administrative areas, but that they're directed toward the classroom?
Oh, I understand, if I may, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that there's the baseline, which is our current situation.
Correct.
As the prototype. If I read from the bottom up, if you will, where total cost for ADMW, and I go up, district overhead, where it looks like we're right on target, centralized support on target, technology on target, centralized, et cetera, et cetera. It's not till you get to textbooks and classroom materials and that sort of thing that are teachers that all of a sudden we don't seem to be doing quite as well. Would that be an accurate?
Your observation, I believe, is accurate.
Well, maybe I could take it, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, a different way. I mean, this is what we currently are spending on administration taken from the database project. That's where we are today. If you're putting additional resources into schools, we are not recommending you put additional resources into administration. We're recommending you put additional resources into schools.
The full prototype mean additional resources? Is that what you mean by that?
Yes.
Yes.
The baseline, just to explain, Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, the baseline is a pretty good picture of what we spend today in a typical school in Oregon. One of the things we did, and I'll explain this in the costing panel, but we actually went out and created what we consider a typical school, so you can understand where we are, and that's what you see in the baseline. And we verified that with the database project and found it to be pretty reliable description. And then what you see in the prototype would be the additional resources that would be available if you had the schools that we think would be required to meet the very high performance expectations we have for Oregon schools.
Okay. Representative Schrader,
comment this off.
This is not the Human Services Committee. He's in rare form this morning.
sir.
I'm kidding.
Sort of out of class here.
Yeah.
Well, it just seems that, you know, in a budget-limited environment, I guess I would rather we're slightly underfunding some of those at the bottom of the list as opposed to some of those at the top part of the list. Would be a logical thought, I think. Okay. In other words, I'd rather us not be quite fully up to snuff with district administrative overhead or some of the other centralized activities. And to the extent that we can get closer to the prototype with our limited dollars, I would probably encourage that to be done.
So, again, the focus of the commission's work was to identify the kind of components that would result in an increase in student achievement. So I think your observation about any areas of enhancement being close to the classroom would reflect the intent of the commission. Again, this is a prototype to help us calculate statewide costs, but as we'll talk about the panels, certainly the identified components reflect both research and best practices that looked at what leverages student achievement. So moving to the area where we began to forecast student performance on reading and math tests with the baseline models and the fully funded models, ask you to look at the first slide there that shows what we could expect if we continued funding at the current level. You will see that, in fact, we would expect that performance would flatten out over the next several years because we believe that it's going to take additional resources to support students who are currently struggling to reach these benchmarks. We worked with consultant Dave Conley from the University of Oregon and the Department of Education to begin these forecasts. And while they're not precise, they are a reasonable starting point given the kind of data that is currently available, and we expect them to improve over time as the data accumulates. The second graph would forecast the student gains in prototype schools that are fully funded at the recommended level. And they also indicate when we would predict that 90% of the students would reach the benchmark. The commission raised the question about current high school structure again and was not confident about when 90% of our 10th graders would be expected to reach the benchmarks. But we do expect, again, as we gather and analyze more school-level data, that we will gain insights into the link between resources, best practices, and student achievement.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Winters.
There was a lot of discussion in about the 90%. It was in the group that I chaired, and we couldn't come to any real conclusion of why 90% as the outer goal, why not 100%? You know, why are we restricting and saying that we won't reach the 100% mark. Did the commission discuss that in detail, and why did they retain the 90% that was still in the that was in the original QEM report?
We discussed a lot, Representative Winters and Mr. Chair, we discussed a lot of various ideas and thoughts about where to set the mark and what kind of expectations we could have in the short term. And certainly, while the educators indicated that they would have high aspirations for all students, they based a lot of the projections on studies that have been done and where the current performance level is. And you know, indicated, you know, that this would be the most reasonable high target that could be set here in the short term, connected purely with resources. You know, as I mentioned, again, it's a starting point, and as we accumulate more data, those targets may be adjusted.
Anything more?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Continue. Yes, Senator Trove.
I was really encouraged to see in all these models that you're doing more with counseling. You're putting the number of counselors at a manageable, working with a manageable number of students. And I'm pleased with that. The high school level especially, I think it's very important to have good counseling. Mm-hmm. I noticed you reduced the number of students that each counselor would deal with. Mm-hmm.
Question?
Yes. Representative Smith.
Through the model, were you able to address the high school dropout rate?
It was discussed, but it was not addressed. And the way that it was discussed, Representative Smith, was it was one of the other very important indicators to look at in addition to test scores as we try to make judgments about whether or not a student is attending a high-performance learning environment. And you know, we talked about the various measures. We certainly discussed how this relates to the report card and the kind of quality indicators that are there. So it was recognized as, you know, a measure of importance. But in terms of our task here of identifying specific components that would result in student achievement, it wasn't the primary focus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we can, again, as we get the data systems better in line, we can do dropout rate recording by high schools better. And again, I think we all recognize that one of the issues we have with high schools is the concern about dropout. So it wasn't like we didn't consider, I mean, we certainly thought a lot about it, but we aren't able right now to do the kind of data tracking by school that I think we need to be doing long term.
Mr. Chair, someone who's been around schools a long time, I know that dropout rate is somewhat determined by the kind of counseling kids get in mm-hmm. schools and whether they mm-hmm. feel they're valued and wanted in the school and so forth. And it seems to me like that you've done some things to address that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes,
Representative Smith, I'm not an education professional, but mm-hmm. it just seems reasonable to me that if we can get kids out of elementary school reading, being able to math, mm-hmm. that they're learning success. And I would just, you know, I would bet you a dollar that we'd have a reduction in dropout rates if we can have kids coming out with those skill sets in place. So, again, that's why we think it's so important to focus on the elementary school start first.
Sure. One of the pieces that's missing, and I must go on record to talk about it because everybody knows what I'm going to say. Duncan is shaking his head, so he knows exactly what I'm going to say, and that is that the P is not in this report.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who haven't heard me a lot, I believe that we need to recognize that we need to start at the preschool level and that our investment there is very important to have children ready when they're coming into kindergarten. So Duncan was doing this.
The P is in Table 1, Prototype.
You're quick this afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Well, Representative Winters, certainly the idea of early childhood education was discussed at length in both the research and practitioner panels. It was also a part of the public opinion survey that we used to try to identify and understand what the community wants from its schools. And it was a, you know, a aggressive recommendation, of course, just to suggest funding all of our current half-day kindergarten programs at into full-day programs. So I think there was a tremendous amount of support for, you know, your beliefs and ideas that early investment is going to make a difference in student achievement and the linkage that, that Mr. Thorndike also made, too, with dropouts.
Okay.
Just wanted to go on the record.
You bet. You are. Duncan, this is for you on table three of the yellow sheet. They're looking at the prototype high school, 1,000 students, and you look down to the cost per ADMW, $4,900 for baseline, $5,600 for full prototype. That's $700 for 1,000 students. That's $700,000 more to operate that high school and the full prototype, right?
Correct.
Okay. If someone brought me this kind of proposal in my business, I first thing I would look at is in the left-hand column, if on a baseline operation, you know, the overhead cost, starting at the bottom there, as Representative Schrader, is the same, $208, and then $142, and then $95, and then $60, $231. The thing that would jump out at me is, wow, if we can run a full prototype on that same number, maybe we can cut on the baselines. Is that faulty thinking? Cut on the baseline costs?
Mr. Chair, I guess the, you certainly can look at each one of these cost components in the baseline, and you could ask if for any each one of these is a, you know, to your question, I think, Representative Schrader, you could certainly ask the question, is the district administrative overhead a reasonable level? And that's certainly a question this committee can ask. I would just point out the database for the first time gives you the ability to ask that question. You now have that data in front of you, and you can take a look at it. If you look at it, the 208 in comparison to the whole, 4978, I frankly was surprised it was as low as it was.
On the baseline school.
On the baseline. Again, this is where we are today. So if you think about this as a zero-based budget, this is simply a description of what we have right now.
Okay.
Typical school in Oregon, the district overhead is around $208. And you can, again, with the database project, take a look at individual districts and see the variation. And a question you could ask is, are we spending too much on administrative overhead? That's a reason we didn't, after looking at these numbers, reach that as a particularly huge issue given the size. I mean, again, it's a relatively small number compared to the total, but it's there, and you can look at any of these. Then the prototype, of course, is simply a different version with more resources added. And again, we didn't add anything more to central office in the prototype. We put all new resources into the schools. But
okay,
again,
I understand what you're saying, but you understand what I think when I look at that and you say you can do the full prototype from those bottom lines for the same as the baseline, well, to me that says spending too much money on the baseline. I mean the baseline school for the administrative overhead and the centralized support and technology service, though all those items that are exactly the same as
yes,
the full prototype.
Yeah, I see that, and I guess our we weren't thinking so much as, I mean, there could be a question. You might want to add, if you put in more money, there may be a case to add more administration. I guess our assumption was the central offices have been pretty leaned down or pushed.
No, I would say you think that they're overly
yeah, and again, you have to get into the individual. Again, it's $208 per student. I don't know, you're in central office, Elaine, you may want to comment on. You're part of that $208. That's what we're talking about. And, you know, again, it's a reasonable question to ask. We did not go into any great depth of looking at the individual elements of the central office function.
But as you know, that's kind of a contentious part of what we have to deal with here, and so that would just be my first, you know, when I look at that, to see that if you say in a full prototype arrangement, which supposedly is going to deliver a higher quality education, you can operate your administrative overhead for the same amount as full prototype as you are baseline school, why maybe you're spending too much on the baseline.
Yeah, I see what your point is.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll have to...
That's the other way. We simply didn't add to the bit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just would say that I think that in terms of our responses to the questions of Representative Schrader, it was just depending on which way you were looking at it, is, you know, an assumption that we made was that while we really need to invest in education in order to get higher student achievement, we made an assumption that we would continue to have higher expectation but the same amount of resources in administration. So I think far from, you know, from feeling like that schools were overstaffed in these areas, given the size of our schools. It was just that, given the ability to invest, we would invest closer to the classroom.
Right, and I understand what you're saying, and I also understand what Senator Trost said. You know, if you're going to provide more counselors for students, move from 333 per counselor to 250. Of course, that costs mm-hmm. more money to do that, and so maybe that's where you're investing mm-hmm. your money in order to improve mm-hmm. the opportunity for quality education.
There's seven more additional staffing in the prototype. That's good. I think that's probably very much needed, and I think it will make the schools more effective, but that's where some of the additional mm-hmm. costs would be.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
The additional staffing. I was surprised that classroom materials and equipment, such an increase in that amount, 159 to 279, must mean that your analysis of what's happening out there is that classroom materials and equipment are really underfunded dramatically and need some help.
This is only the school.
Okay. You have more?
Could they respond?
Excuse me.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Trove. I think that what you find reflected in the baseline is the level of funding right now in our schools for supplies and equipment following several years of budget cuts. So looking at both what individual schools and individual school districts have done, they've often reduced supplies and equipment and other support materials kind of in order to maintain program. That certainly would be true of our own, the school district that, you know, that I represent. So I think it's typical, and so they're looking for the opportunity to try to bring that level of resource back up where we know students will have current materials, current books, maps, globes, and also the other kind of technological resources they need.
Ms. Sheridan, a lot of schools in the last 10 years have had to cut staffing substantially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So adding back staffing gets at some mm-hmm. of those problems as well. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Wish to continue?
Okay. And the second set of graphs show the similar forecast for math performance. The first one showing it at the current level. And the second one with an investment at the recommended resource level, and once again showing what it kind of expectation the additional resources would generate and when we would specifically hope to have 90% of our students meet or exceed the math benchmarks. I'd like to kind of go back into process a little bit. And as was stated earlier, I think by Gene Thorne, this commission was made up of 11 members. It included educators, business people, and parents. The commission process involved using national consultants. We worked with management analysis planning, specifically Larry Pikus from USC and James Guthrie from Vanderbilt. We also received input from a special legislative committee chaired by Representative Winters and Representative Hobson. And we worked through four expert panels. A very diverse group of Oregonians that represent the major stakeholders comprised these four panels. And it was certainly an expanded base of input. The panels gathered and reviewed information in four different areas. The first panel, the perception and communication panel, strove to answer the question, what does the public want? And what do they believe makes a difference in education? The second panel, content and goals, asked the question, what does research tell us? The third panel, the practitioner panel, asked, what will the practitioners tell us? And the fourth panel, resource and cost, asked, what will a quality education cost? The communication and perception panel conducted a public opinion poll to understand the public priorities for Oregon School. These priorities were included in the Commission's phase-in plan, which focuses on elementary reading and professional development. In terms of the content and goals and practice and delivery panels, they met separately at first, but they began working together as much of their work overlapped. Their task was to design the prototype schools that could be expected to reach the quality education goals. Several themes began to emerge from their study of the research. The panels discussed both tangible and intangible factors that determine high-performing schools. Providing the adequate resource to schools alone is not enough. There are intangible factors or quality indicators which play an important role in the quality ed model because they determine how effectively resources are used in the school setting, and here are some examples of those intangible factors. The Department of Education will be working with schools to assess these indicators and provide technical assessment for improvement. The model does make assumptions about how well these intangible qualities are in place and the role that they play in affecting the wise decision about use of resources. With that, I think we go back to Duncan.
Well, now we turn back to the cost. The fourth panel was the cost panel. I chaired that group, and we were the bean counters, and we had a lot of the finance directors from school districts, and our, I believe Bill was on it, Jerry Meyer, a number of others, business folks. And what we tried to do is ask ourselves, do we have a system that can translate from the school level to the state budget level? Do we have good data? Do we have information? So we tried to review the underlying components of the quality education model that had been produced earlier. We tried to understand the assumptions that were made in that. And we spent the time to look at the quality education schools against real live schools. We actually brought in districts into the process. We predicted what a typical school would look like at the allocation you made last time using the model. We took your, I forget the 4 point whatever the $1 billion, we translated into school level estimates of what the schools would look like, and then we actually compared that, and that became the baseline school with actual schools, and what we learned was that we're pretty close. These are the, it's a good, we have a good way to translate from these very big aggregate numbers to what actual schools can do in Oregon. So I think we feel this is a very reliable model. We did have to make some adjustments as we went, and we'll continue to have to make adjustments. Maintenance was an area, for example. We didn't have the maintenance numbers right originally. We had to adjust. But basically, we found it was a good model. We particularly found that the prototype school model, this approach, is a good one. And we found it, the national consultants reviewed it and found it to be conceptually sound and very, very similar to other models for translating school level to state level financial data in other states, some of the other states that have been using this. Our findings were that it does predict costs with reasonable accuracy. It's a very good number crunching tool, and it's particularly useful for making adjustments from current program levels. If you ask the question, as I think Elaine mentioned, what would it cost us to decrease class size? The model is very good at doing what ifs. If you want to ask, what if we need more professional development in our schools? We can run the numbers. Brian Reeder and Nancy Heiligman are very quick. They could do this, you know, in the course of minutes in front of you. So you can, if you want to suggest different models for what you'd like schools to look like in this committee, you have now a very powerful tool for understanding what the cost differences would be. There are areas for improvement. This will, as I say, get better over time as we get better data with the database project. We understand that one of the things we need to do, and I know you heard about yesterday, was the CSL level and connecting the model with the CSL. We can do a better job ultimately in doing that. These are done separately, and we connected the baseline with last year's budget, but from taking the baseline up to current CSL, we didn't use the model to do that, and the next time I think we could.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Trump.
Have you seen Mr. Stinson's analysis of the current service level and his belief that it's been overestimated in terms of the cost?
I have seen it, but Mr. Chair, Senator Trump, this is not an area I would pretend to be knowledgeable on. I mean, I've followed this. A separate group worked on CSL. I've heard the arguments. The CSL, as I understand it, there's arguments in both directions on where it is. The only thing I can tell you, again, we looked at last biennium's numbers and connected them all to it, but I haven't taken the. I have not. I don't feel
extra true.
I was just wondering whether, since you can estimate using the QEM, you can estimate the current service level,
mm-hmm.
And yet that was done in this budget, and there's some dispute about it. I guess we need to look and see how you refine that so that this can be done.
Yeah,
Senator Cho, I'm going to go over with that report that we had yesterday from LOF with Duncan today, and so we see that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Duncan, one of the discussions that we had, and I wondered if you were able to resolve it, when we discussed the QEM model, and that was if a district chose or chose not to do the model, what kind of linkages do you have from, you know, this mm-hmm. body? You know, we're saying that we're giving them a market basket approach that they can pick and choose. Where does the accountability lie? How do we know that they really did carry it out and use those dollars in the ways that they so picked and choose? And I wondered, how did your committee have come up with some solutions for that? Because I think that is critical when we talk about implementing the model. You know, it's one thing to say that you're going to allocate X amount of dollars, but if you're going to do it based on this market basket approach, where does the accountability come in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that is, I think, every one of the panel members' favorite question. If you had not asked that at some point, we would have been wildly disappointed. It's the key question. It's the next question, really, that proceeds with the QEM. What we've done with the quality education model is estimate what performance can be expected at different funding levels, and we describe what a school, we think a school would look like, tangible and intangible factors that would lead to that result. But we are not asking every school in Oregon to do what this commissioner we would suggest, you know, because we believe in local flexibility and autonomy. I guess the first simple answer is what you will know next session if you pass a budget out with this approach is you can come back next session with the database and examine the performance and actual budgets of every school in Oregon, which is a huge deal. And to be able to say, here's a school that performed very well and here's how they spent their dollars, we in the Quality Education Commission can take a look at the best practice schools for helping refine the model for the future. You will also be in a position to look at the schools that didn't do particularly well or may have not spent the dollars in the way that we would suggest and ask questions of them. But the specific accountability from the state, the district, to the school level is, I think we all agree, a huge governance question. It's in front of you now with this model. If you take a look at what's happened in education policy in Oregon with the standards movement, now the quality education model in the database, it cries for a whole new conversation about accountability. I think the one thing we all agree on is there needs to be local flexibility on how you spend the dollars. Although schools ultimately need to be accountable to the results, you do not want to be in a position in saying you've got to spend each dollar this way. I mean, I don't think that's philosophically where any of us want to go. And Elaine, that's my quick answer, and it's a huge.
Yeah, if I might add something, Representative Winters and Mr. Chair, I believe it's House Bill 2298 that looks at the school improvement grant, and my guess is the State Department will talk to you more about this tomorrow. But certainly, the way that school districts are constructing their budget at this time involves a set aside for an investment in the elementary grades to raise the student scores on the reading and math benchmarks. In working through that process in my own district, we've developed a plan for investment and identified it back to the components in the quality ed model. We've linked the suggested components in our specific activity and how much that would cost us, and set a target again of 90% of our third graders being either meeting or exceeding the reading benchmarks by June of 2003. Which, of course, would be the end of our next biennium. So that was the plan to, you know, kind of phase it in from grade 3 to grade 5 to grade 8 and to take money and specifically invest it in what research and best practice says will make a difference in student learning. And I believe the State Department, if the budget goes through as proposed and that bill is enacted, then the State Department will develop for us a specific accountability where we have to submit plans in order to access that part of the budget.
Okay. Yes, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the panel to respond to some statistics that I have found. First of all, I don't believe that money can buy success, and obviously money can be wasted. In my district, 86% of the budget is salaries, so that's where the money is going. But I'd like you to respond to these statistics. Texas last year ranked 24th in yearly spending per student, but first in test results. Iowa was 21st in spending, third in test results. Louisiana was 14th in spending, 47th in test results. California was 38th in spending, last in test results. So there doesn't seem to be across the country a correlation between test results and spending. How do you explain that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, this is not, I think we have looked at a lot of those studies, and again, I think depending on which researcher, whether there's a correlation, there's a great debate on this. What I would stress in this is not about simply putting more money in the schools without any form of accountability. This puts more money with an expectation there'll be higher performance. And if you hit these performance targets, as indicated in the quality education model, Oregon would be right up at the top in terms of school performance against national norms. We've set these at world-class standards and asked, what is it going to take to achieve, what would schools look like that we believe can achieve world-class academic performance and provide the well-rounded education that we think Oregonians want for their children. But this is not simply about putting more money without any expectations for performance improvement. This expects performance improvement. It's built into the quality education model, and you're going to see the performance of every single school in the state if you apply this approach.
Certainly.
That's my next question. How can you compare nationally if you're using Oregon assessments? How do you compare with other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, one of the things Oregon does, while we do have our own assessment system for the standards, we also do use the NAEP for selected students. We also do use, Oregon's one of the states that has also used the international testing for math and science, the TIMSS, and we can have the Oregon breakout. So we not only have our own state assessment, but we can also benchmark that against the national norms and international norms. Elaine, you probably have. I should give that one to you, actually.
Well, Representative Close, Mr. Chair, I think that Mr. Weiss has answered it well, is that we have a pretty comprehensive assessment system going right now, which does include a mix of the state-level assessment, which is very important in that it's aligned with the curriculum that is being taught, and also participation in some national measures. And, you know, kind of referencing back to, you know, your first question, there's a lot of questions that have to be answered to compare that data. When we hear that Texas scored first, we have to ask, who participated in that assessment? Were all children assessed, or were some children excluded? What measure did they use? Certainly the cost of living, the percentage of disadvantaged children, there's so many factors that go into the funding level, and those kind of correlations, I think, invite a lot of discussion and scrutiny. But more than anything, a list of questions are generated first rather than a lot of answers or conclusions.
Follow up?
Certainly.
The testing used was the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And I guess my next question is, you said you do some testing with selected students, so you're only testing with selected students, and how do you select those students?
It's more of a sample, not a selection of students, but there is not a mandatory statewide participation. So some schools and some grade level participate in order to have that national reference and check. That's important to everyone. It's not comprehensive in that it's not required. It takes a lot of resources to do so.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest to the committee that until our students are taking national assessments, it's very difficult to keep them accountable. Especially looking at the nationwide results, which shows that the more spending does not reflect higher test scores. And I think we need to look at that, because they're Oregon assessments.
Right, I agree, Representative. In fact, Wayne Neuberger probably knows as much about testing and assessments, and we'll get him back here. I'm really excited about the TESA project, which will allow us to do, you know, testing every year at every grade level and be able to compare to other states, and you're absolutely right that we don't know how we're doing unless we can find a way to compare to other states.
Thank you. Right.
Mr. Chair, this is something I've spent a great deal on, but the benchmarking process, and just to stress, there are two different reasons to do assessment. One is for individual student assessment. I think the state assessment system is a good one to measure against how we're doing on standards, and I think that's appropriate. At the same time, it's important to do cross-section of the students and adults, for that matter, of how we're doing And if you look at those cross-sectional numbers, which we've looked at fairly closely, Oregon does really well on some, for example, on adult literacy. We're at the top of the nation when we did that several years ago. On international math, we look very good in Oregon, and at the eighth grade and in science. So I'll get you the data. We have comparative data, Oregon against other states. I'm not familiar with the report you have, Representative Close. But again, I would agree we need to be benchmarking our test scores against national and international standards. And there are ways to do that as part of it. You don't have to make the state assessment system to do that. There are ways to do that without changing the entire state assessment system, which gives us great data to track progress over time, which, again, is also very important if you look at the data. We have almost 10 years of data now to compare how students today are doing against students in Oregon 10 years ago, and that's also very important. We don't want to lose that data stream either. So, enough said.
Duncan, I have a question that brings the reality of the day. You can answer this, or you can have Elaine answer it. This committee, it looks favorably upon people named Elaine who are superintendents or former superintendents. We think there's a lot of authority there. But I'm looking again at Table 3. The prototype, 1,000 students, high school. And looking down at the bottom, it's going to be $5,600 more to move from baseline to full prototype. So $700 on 1,000 high school students. That's $700,000 on that particular high school. Okay, look at my Beaverton district. We have 5 high schools, Beaverton, Sunset, Westview, Aloha, and South Ridge, and they're all over 2,000, so there's approximately 10,000 students. So if we move to your prototype, we'd have to build 5 more high schools to get that 1,000 per school building. And, of course, we don't even need to discuss that because that's not going to happen.
Right.
And the other thing, then, that... I'm going to give you I've got a formula. It's 20-10-5. What that means is, in my Senate district, there's 3 school districts, Portland, Beaverton, Hillsboro. Portland has to cut their budget if we're going to adopt $5.2 billion, $20 million, and Beaverton, $10 million, and Hillsboro, $5 million. And I really believe in the QEM as a tool, a working tool, but how do I develop, a budget? And 5.2 seems to be a number that everybody is comfortable with. And when the 3 districts, have to cut $35 million in this upcoming biennium, how do I answer that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that you're going to find that most Oregon school districts are going to be talking about program reductions and cuts, even with 5.2. And I know that's a message that most folks probably sitting on the other side of the table don't want to hear. But I think we've simply got costs that exceed whatever is determined to be the current service level. We all know that we've got runaway costs in insurance, in energy, as well as labor costs, and there's no ability for us to charge the customer more, so to speak. So I think that those figures that you gave are representative, not atypical. So that's just an acknowledgement, not a solution to that. Makes it the challenge then in terms of investing in the first phase of the quality ed model is more difficult in that it basically requires a redeployment of resources, and it may need to be initially there'll be some reduction in some services at some level in order to invest in early childhood education. We talked about that as a commission, and as I'm in conversations with other superintendents, that's turning out to be the reality as we're trying to construct our budgets this spring, kind of awaiting for final numbers.
Well, Mr. Chair, the one thing I'd say using the QEM is, again, if you look at those underlying cost categories, the kinds of cost increases Elaine mentions could be added to the model, and you could adjust it accordingly. I mean, we have assumptions about operating and maintenance. If they're higher, then you could go in and readjust the QEM. What I would suggest is that the baseline schools, even though it's a 1,000-person high school, you can simply double it and get the picture of a baseline school for Beaverton. You could compare what their actual costs compared to the QEM costs are and see where the differences are. That's an exercise we could do, and my guess is that there are some cost elements here that when we estimated this earlier based on historic trends, that there's some costs that are higher now that may suggest why some of the cuts are necessary.
Senator Troll.
I suppose if that $1 billion of money were there in the budget at full funding of the QEM, most school districts wouldn't have the problems they're having. But you're not funding the QEM at full funding. What percentage funding is it? 90, 80?
Well, the CSL is, well, maybe we should run through the numbers. That's actually the next slide. We
certainly
to that. Let's just take a look at what this costs. Again, what we did was we asked what would it cost to fund the prototype schools, as you saw them on the right-hand side, and we then and ran that up, and the number was $6 billion, roughly. And that compares with CSL that I think you're seeing, which is 5.089. So you can see the differences. And again, that would be the full funding. To give you a little different perspective to describe what that means in the different grade levels, in terms of the next slide, that would be about $600 million more in the elementary school years, 91 in middle school, high school is 180. And we also would recommend that we create a special pool for high cost special education. That's such a different category of service. We'd recommend you translate it out in the budget. To give you one final look at this, again, as Senator Hartung was talking, again, at that size, and again, those are prototypes, and if you can up the scale simply by multiplying additional students. But at the high school, for example, of a 1,000-person high school, Senator Hartung, you were correct, about $810,000 additional dollars for a 1,000-person high school. And again, this gives you a perspective on additional funding at those grade levels. But then finally, just tried to put this, it sounds like a lot of money, and it is. I mean, this is clearly a huge resource commitment. But this just puts it in some perspective. This is the ADM weighted over the decade of the 90s, and you can see it's declined. What this would do at this funding level is put us about, if inflation adjusted, about where we were before Measure 5. In some districts, frankly, this would not be as much money as they had before Measure 5.
Let's see, is that the $5.2 billion or the $6 billion?
Six billion. So we've seen the cut. So again, looking at other states, this would still not put us at the top end of funding. These are schools that I think you could reasonably say, you'd want your kids there. These are good schools. They would be high performing schools. The difference between this funding level and what we had at the beginning of this decade was the performance expectations are vastly higher at this funding level. If you put this, at that funding level, you would have in receiving those results on the state assessment, you would have by any definition world-class educational delivery in Oregon. So that,
yes, Senator Trump.
It's just a good reason why, if you think about the entire budget, the governor has to deal with the entire budget, how it was not possible to fund this at full QEM numbers simply because there was not enough money to go around in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so those folks who say that somehow or other we have more than enough money to do everything we're committed to do are just not seeing the picture as we see as we try to make these decisions. It would be nice to fund this at the full level because then we wouldn't have these cuts. And Corvallis is thinking about closing schools. We've got a commission that's looking at closing at least one elementary school, maybe more. One middle school and so forth, simply because with the money they're anticipating, more money than maybe they thought they would get, it's not enough to keep them going. They've got problems. And I think that's going to be true for lots of school districts, even with this funding. If we had the full QEM model funding, it'd probably be a different story. But I don't see how we can afford to do that with the kind of budget responsibilities we have.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Salem has we're growing, so we're adding schools. But I want to touch on another issue because I heard Elaine talk about poverty and some of those issues that we've talked about in our committee, and those variables that are outside may have a different impact on the prototype model because you're talking about some different variables that may not fit into the prototype, and I don't know how you address those in your committee, in your commission.
Well, Representative Winters, Mr. Chair, we again assumed that this is one of the really important reasons for local school districts and schools to make choices and decisions that reflected their student populations. And so how the resources might be spent in one elementary school versus another. We can all think of communities where that would predictably be very different because of the kind of support that is needed for kids that don't have a rich home life with respect to educational experiences or a lot of just adult support.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, we did assume in the prototype school a certain number of young of children in poverty, a certain number of special ed and English as a second language. So we did assume, but it was not a typical. I mean, it was actually slightly overweighted to the average. But as Elaine says, you know, obviously any individual school would be different, and that gets into the whole issue of distribution, which we did not get into. This said this what a typical school with a typical population. This is what it would cost. Then your statewide number, then you have a second question of how you distribute it among the schools, and that we did not.
And my other question is, did you find a school, our school in Oregon, where you had a 90% academic achievement rate so that it did become a typical prototype?
Representative Winters, there are some elementary schools that have 90% or greater percent of the students that are meeting and or exceeding the benchmarks in reading and math. But we did not use those schools as, you know, the models in terms of the components. You know, what we're probably looking for is schools that, you know, have, again, kind of exceeded expectations in terms of the various comparable groups that are put together by the state system. But we didn't work backwards as you're suggesting.
That will be a strategy for the future, though, as we go forward. I mean, we're seeing more and more schools that are hitting those, and we'll be able to use those as with the database project as research for future QAM results.
Because that was part of our discussion, that you can learn from those schools that are successful and do some adaptation from those, if, you know, and also get some assistance from those that will help support the underachieving schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative, that is absolutely the key to the database, and we're seeing more and more of that happening. I just in Multnomah County, for example, I just was in a meeting this week where superintendents were talking with each other about best practice schools, identifying those that were really working well, and they're going to learn from each other, and that's the power of this whole new system.
There may be hope for us yet.
Yes, the School of Champions will come alive again. Representative Schrader.
Are you kind of getting at what I was wondering? I mean, to the extent we've had the database for a very short period of time, and I guess I need to know at some point from the department how functional it has been and when it, quote, is available. So, you know, are school districts starting to try and talk to one another, looking at what's going on? Are you aware of any of that?
Let me give, Mr. Chair, Representative Sherry, let me give my example. OBC, we did it directly. We did a presentation for David Douglas in Portland. They were both two of the pilots, and Deirdre on my staff did a comparative analysis of the two districts, presented to both school boards, went through line item by line item, identifying where their strengths and weaknesses were against each other, with central office costs, maintenance costs, very instructive for both districts, I think, and helped them get very focused. And again, I heard lots of stories of principals picking up the phone saying, what are these folks doing down in Corvallis or in McMinnville, and finding out, just noticing on the database that there's some good results there. So we're, I think, seeing more and more of this, and that, again, is, the database is relatively new, but it's just absolutely critical and very effective tool for building the kind of high-performance schools we need in the state.
That's good. That's very encouraging. That's exactly, I think, what we'd like to be seeing. But then it begs the question, why is the QEM so important? You know, if I can just call up David Douglas and find out how come you guys are at 90% and I am not.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the QEM is important to you. It's your tool that you can use, using the database to define what you think is an appropriate level of funding, using the database to describe what you think a quality school looks like at the elementary, middle, and high school, and to create your expectations of what that school can produce for Oregonians. So it's really the why we're so excited to be here. This is your tool. It's your way to use the database.
Can I paraphrase that then? So what you're saying is the QEM is a way for the legislature to feel fairly confident that if we allocate X number of dollars and theoretically, you know, have it geared around a certain performance in a specific area, we should feel comfortable, getting a Representative Close's question, that, okay, that's enough dollars to do that job.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take more dollars. It takes, you know, organization or best school practices, and then that would get the principals on the phone saying, uh-oh, geez, we theoretically, we want to deliver anyway,
right,
but, you know, we feel we may have some problems, and the database initiative then comes into play there where they can call around and say, all right, you know, here's the, quote, official model, but that's actually a budgetary exercise for us. How do you do it? And you may actually look at some of those elements of the model.
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Ideally, when this last session is done, people like Elaine will be, and other school superintendents around the state will be comparing their database results with the state prototypes, seeing and as a way of identifying what your expectations are, and then, again, with the aim you created, 90% reading benchmarks in third and fifth grade, thinking through strategies to achieve them and looking at the database as for alternative models. But you will have produced your vision for what you think schools can produce, and that's going to be a very powerful message to the school committee. So it holds you accountable in the sense that you need to make sure the dollars are available to do what you think is reasonable, but then the schools then have that in mind for their and need to be accountable to you to then produce the results.
Yeah, one other thing, Duncan, while we're on this also, and we've talked about this before, and as you know, this afternoon in the Education Committee, we're going to have a bill to make the SIM and the CAM optional and whatnot. And so keep trying to relate back to, has school reform really and truly, you know, improved the quality of education we get? And I don't know how you measure that, but here's what I get all the time. People come to me and say, 1995, the K-12 budget was $3 billion. In 2001, you're asking for $5.2 billion. Now, will the quality of education or the learning opportunity for our children be that much better in this upcoming biennium than it was in the biennium following the 95 session? And, you know, I really believe in the QEM as a tool to get us there sometime, as Representative Schrader just mentioned. But, boy, you know, trying to tell my constituents, you know, just wait, we've got a great tool here. We're going to be able to demonstrate that we put an appropriate amount of money to it, why the quality of education will improve. And so help me. How do I respond to that?
Mr. Chair, do you have the book with you?
Yes.
You do. Please turn to page 20.
All right.
And we this is something the Business Council put together, and we tried to summarize a lot of information, which I think will help provide some perspective. What it does is it gives the results on the reading benchmarks and the math benchmarks at the different grade levels at the beginning of the decade and the end of the decade. There's a lot of positive to talk about. At the beginning of the decade, 52% hit the third grade reading benchmark. Today we're at 82%. Huge improvement. In fifth grade, 51% to 73%, about a 20% gain in that period. The reform has had an effect on teaching and learning in Oregon, and I see it in my own kids' education. I mean, they were definitely more focused on reading and math objectives. It trails off as you move into the upper grade levels, and we're not hitting standards, but both in terms of the percentage meeting and the absolute average scores, they're going up. We also in there try to talk, how much do we spend? Obviously, the challenge you face and explain to your constituents is property taxes have been dropping while the state funds. The only way to reasonably talk about this is total funds available for education. And we summarize that data as well, adjusted for poverty, special ed, and you can see the results. We were spending more at the beginning of the decade than at the end when you adjust for poverty and special ed. And we also, in that period of time, equalized funding among schools, which was a huge change in Oregon policy in a period where we're reducing budgets on average. We equalized funding, which absolutely hammered a number of
schools. Pulling them up, but also
pulling them down. So some schools, some of your districts,
all right,
could
well,
be huge.
Corvallis,
Corvallis was certainly
testing higher than 52% 10 years ago.
And so this tries to summarize a decade of work. And again, I think when you step back and ask, we made some accomplishments. I think there's a lot to be proud of in Oregon. It's been a tough decade. We're not where we want to be, but we've shown enormous improvements. The beauty of the quality education model system is you can articulate what you expect schools to produce. The schools community has committed to producing it. If you put out the budget at the funding level that the governor recommended, you should be coming back asking every school in the state whether they're hitting the third and fifth grade reading benchmarks at 90%, which would be an enormous, enormous step forward for Oregon in the future of education.
Yeah, Representative Schrader.
You had indicated, this is very interesting, I appreciate the opportunity to have this type of discussion, actually. You indicated, who was Lane, a part of the testimony that the school districts would theoretically, on the $220 million we're talking about, come in with a plan potentially. And I would like you to comment on, do we really need them to come in with a plan if we have performance measures? In other words, to the extent that they tell us, yes, we are going to commit to that 90% level for reading, or if you're at reading for math or whatever, do we have to have them go through that hoop, if you will, of providing us the material and DOE looking at the material and saying, yes, this is good, rather than just say, fine, you know, here's the deal. If you want this money, you have to commit to do this and get everyone, every school district to commit to doing, achieving this benchmark. And if they achieve it, great, they've done it, and hopefully good consequences flow. And if they don't, then somehow there's some other consequence that they will also commit to it. So is there an advantage in having the plan?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'm sure there's a lot of superintendents that would certainly go along with what you're suggesting might be a good idea. But it is a major part of what the Department of Education is trying to look at in terms of accountability, because we are also very cognizant and along the line of an earlier discussion that people do want some increased accountability for this level of funding. What benefits can come our way as educators from that process? Again, it's probably building some good data.